Welcome to the B-side. Tyler here with you, as always, joined by Pastor Steve. Welcome. How you feeling? How's that?
A little better.
That Batman voice.
Yeah, I took a sick day yesterday.
Yeah.
After working sick for the last week.
That's the case, right? And there's probably have nothing to catch up on either, right?
Yeah, well, it's a quiet time of year with Easter and everything.
Yeah. So that could be one of the challenges in this line of work, is that you may be sick around holidays, but your job never is, really.
But I'm doing okay. We'll take as many questions as we can until I fall into a hacking, coughing fit, and then that'll be the end.
Fair enough.
And just end with hack.
Yeah. B-side. In case you weren't around on Sunday or you're listening to this later, we'll give you a little context. We finished our Ezekiel series on Sunday. I think really, I would say from my understanding, really well received overall from people. I think
series or message?
The series. Yeah. The message, I didn't get to spend a ton of time talking to people after church because we jettisoned right away to we were hosting some people at our house for a young adults thing. But the young adults talked about the message on Sunday. Found it really hopeful and enjoyable. But I think overall the series, my two cents, just as my wife and I have talked about it over the course of the last couple of months, just found it interesting because it's not, you know, if I were planning a preaching series for Sunday morning, that wouldn't be my, that would probably be at the bottom of my list of books that I would want to tackle. I mean, it helped that you'd taken a seminary class on it recently, obviously, and been spent some intensive study. But no, I thought it was a really helpful word for a church in general, just understanding how God works with his people and this restorative, how does he balance kind of his glory and his what he expects with the reality of our sin.
It was challenging because some of the passages are controversial, not controversial, but there's pretty differing opinions on how to interpret them. So like the way I interpret them isn't necessarily the way everyone interprets them. So there's some of that, and it's some long sections, complex sections. But like, I mean, I wrote an article for the district. They asked me to share a story for the district website. I don't know if you saw that.
Right, I did,
And I just kind of reflected on our time in Ezekiel. And I think what Ezekiel does is he gives us a bit of a different view of God than we typically get.
Right.
Like, yes, God is love and gracious. And we really see that coming out at the end of the book, his grace and restoration and patience with his sinful people. But there's also this side of God that we, I think, often diminish, his holiness, sovereignty, his power. He's so much bigger and different and utterly different than us. And I think that side of things needs to be emphasized as well. I think in other times, in other cultures, that's been the dominant view, and we need to be reminded of his grace.
Hmm.
So, like, there's a
balance.
A balance or a tension that's supposed to be there. But, yeah, I think that, I mean, Ezekiel was challenging. It was tough sometimes to preach it, but it was, it's a good book. I've said before, I felt like for some people, who have never really read the book or really were, if they did, they didn't really necessarily understand it. It's almost as if we added a book to the Bible for people. Like, reading it with such interest because it was just inaccessible. I mean, that's the challenge of the prophets, is they're beautiful and amazing, compelling, but inaccessible. They're hard to get into.
Yeah.
The context.
But I found myself for the first time, and Ezekiel's probably not a book I've read a lot of. I probably had read it one or two times before this, maybe. But I found myself reading it as we were going through the series, and finding that very thing. Like, I think the difference I would say for me that I noticed in it was that before I felt like I was grazing on Ezekiel. So, like, you know, you're hungry and you're grabbing a few nuts from the bowl or whatever. This was felt more like I sat down for a meal with Ezekiel and got a lot more content and it was a lot more filling. But we're moving on now from Ezekiel. But we did get a question in this week with respect to the last nine. Is that how many chapters you preached?
Yeah, 40 to 48. Overview,
of Ezekiel. But we were talking about the temple and the building of the temple and some of the, I mean, a lot of those chapters are just filled with details about the measurements and the
rituals
and how things like should go. But one of the questions that came in was, does this temple city structure in Ezekiel Does it relate to the city this prophesied and talked about in the book of Revelation? Like, are they literal cities, or are they kind of pointing us to something else?
Yeah. We touched on that, but obviously with 9 chapters and lots to go through, we didn't really have as much time as we could have on the relationship between Ezekiel's temple vision and John's vision of the new creation. And there's going to be different opinions, different interpretations. My take, my interpretation is that they're actually talking about the same thing. There's some key differences, but I think those key differences are not telling us that they're two different things, but they speak more to like progressive revelation and seeing things from the other side of the cross. And so I think that Ezekiel is not describing the blueprints for a temple that's going to be built in the future. Some would say yes. I'm saying that's not what he's doing. But I actually think he is describing the new creation, but doing so in temple imagery. So as a priest writing to a people who just had the temple destroyed and who need to be comforted that God will be present with them when God restores them, he'll be present with them in this amazing, unhindered way. The way he describes that, the kind of controlling metaphor in this vision, is a temple, a perfect temple. A temple where God's presence is not just in the inner part, but is in the whole city complex, and where water flows out of this temple in such a way that it kind of produces a Garden of Eden type effect in the surrounding area, and a redistribution of the land where it's symmetrical and perfect as well, and all the tribes are represented. And I think there's a lot of clues in it that lead us to say that it's not literally going to happen, but instead is a theological message, a figurative encouragement pointing ahead to something that will actually happen, but not in necessarily in this specific way. So I think Ezekiel is describing the new creation. Certainly, going ahead to John, to Revelation, John describes the new creation using Ezekiel imagery. And the last few chapters of Revelation are heavily patterned after Ezekiel. Even from like Gog shows up,
right?
In, as some of the people that the guys that are destroyed by God, there's the a tour guide with a measuring stick, measuring things, measuring the city, this holy city that comes down, and there's a river, tree of life. Fruit that's for healing, not just healing of Israel, but healing of the nations. Instead, the water isn't coming from the temple because there's no temple, but the water's coming from the throne. And the temple is the representation of God's presence, and the throne is the representation of God's presence.
And wasn't that the imagery that also existed in Ezekiel, that the water would
flow from water from the temple.
Yeah.
So the water in Ezekiel is from the temple.
Okay, right.
Temple. From coming out of the temple underneath the door. In Revelation, the water's coming from the throne of God and the Lamb. So I think they're describing the same thing, and the difference is that Ezekiel views or describes the new creation in temple-like imagery, and John describes it as this new creation Eden city, using Ezekiel-type imagery. Except the big difference is John says there's actually no temple, not because God's presence isn't there, but because God's presence is there in such an unhindered way that there's no need for a temple, that it's back to Eden. So, and both,
I personally like that idea. I mean, I mean, I'm interrupting you, obviously, but this thought of hearkening back to kind of Old Testament, God's presence exists in a space, as opposed to that was an establishment as a result of the fall.
Yeah,
that he had, they had confined himself or whatever, but that Eden is back,
yeah,
essentially,
yeah. And that's like the temple is this representation of Eden. The new temple, Ezekiel's vision of the temple, is a greater Eden that produces Eden-like results, like the flourishing trees and healing of the people, and the river that brings life. And is John's vision of the new creation is extremely Edenic, Eden-like.
Did you just make up a word?
No, that's legit. Okay, it's just right. Sort of the type of word that someone would make fun of me for using.
Yeah. Which is kind of what I'm doing, but...
Edenic.
But yes, because you're my superior, you know what's a funny word? Asking it.
Ezekielian. Ezekielian.
Ezekielian?
Yes.
Ezekielian.
So that you'd say John uses Ezekielian imagery. Oh, man. I'm botched.
Yeah. Well, you gotta change the emphasis of the syllables of his name.
You're
Ezekiel.
Super dork if you can.
And then Ezekielian.
Yeah, something like that.
The Simpsons guy.
So I think my interpretation is that Ezekiel and John are actually referencing the same thing in their own way, in their own unique way. But Ezekiel, you have to remember the context. Like, Ezekiel is writing to exiles that just witnessed the temple being destroyed and feel like God is not present with them and God has abandoned them. And his message of comfort and hope to them is that, no, there's a day coming when God will dwell with you in a perfect, more beautiful, and more abundant way. And that message is conveyed through a vision of a temple. And John pictures to these seven churches in Asia Minor who are suffering that, yes, it's dark, yes, things look bad, but God will dwell with his people in this perfect, abundant, amazing way.
Hmm.
And they describe that same thing, new creation, the end of all things, the new city, the new Jerusalem, whichever image, whatever term you want to define it as. They're describing it in from different perspectives, but the same thing.
Hmm.
Is it literal? Yeah, I mean, as much as the Bible can, I think metaphors, imagery, these things have limitations. But yeah, they're telling us in concrete terms what's to come, new creation, the resurrection, and what that looks like. And so there's different images that the Bible uses to describe the same literal thing.
Hmm.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I mean, it's interesting the more I feel like I've understood Ezekiel, which is probably leaps and bounds since what I knew before. I never realized how Ezekiel's fingerprints, the book of Ezekiel's fingerprints, are throughout scriptures. I read through Nehemiah today, preparing for a lesson teaching the junior high kids tonight, and going like, I understand Nehemiah better now.
Huh.
Because I'm like, this is happening after, right? Like, they're talking about the exiles, they're talking about Babylon, they're talking about the city being built, or the walls being rebuilt and stuff, and you're going, oh, so this is part of, like, and they fell back into sin, and there's a pattern that's existed throughout.
What's really interesting is that Ezekiel's actually not ever quoted in the New Testament directly.
Hmm.
One of the few Old Testament books that are not directly quoted. And yet, there's many places where there's clear allusion or hints or drawing on Ezekiel's imagery. Revelation uses Ezekiel heavily, never quoting, but often using similar type imagery. The four-headed beasts in the chapter 1 vision, the kavod, show up in Revelation, and the guy with the measuring stick and the river and all this. And then Jesus seems to really, especially in the book of John describes Jesus and some of the things he says and does.
The Son of Man.
I think that's different.
I remember you saying that.
Because the Son of Man imagery seems definitely, they're different, but it seems definitely from Daniel chapter 7.
Oh,
not
right.
Ezekiel.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But
this is why you sit in that chair and I sit in this chair. Yeah.
The shepherd imagery.
Right.
Jesus is a good shepherd. John 10 is I think, clearly Ezekiel 34 language. We often think of Psalm 23, but Ezekiel 34 is, and that's why they get so mad at him, the religious leader, the authorities.
Right.
The John 3, the only way to really make sense of the water and the spirit passage is not that in John 3, you must be born of water and the spirit. People have suggested water means birth, so like birth and new birth, but it doesn't make sense in Greek. It doesn't work. There's no reference to being born by water as being physical birth. Or baptism doesn't really make sense either in the context and the flow of things. And Nicodemus would not understand that. How come Jesus? But that it must be a reference to Ezekiel 34, that the sprinkling of water and sprinkling with the Spirit. And that's so Jesus is saying that the new birth is the new birth that Ezekiel was talking about. And you're a teacher of Israel and you don't understand these things? Makes sense that he's referencing Ezekiel. Of all people, Nicodemus, an Old Testament scholar, should know this. You don't get this? So, and there's other places where it seems that Jesus is casting his ministry in Ezekiel as a fulfillment of Ezekiel 34 to 48. Hmm. So, never quoted, but often referenced, it seems.
Well, I know I'm speaking for a lot of people when I say I've appreciated the series and the work you've put into it. I think it's been edifying for the church. It's been good. Yeah. I'm super stoked for Acts.
Yeah.
I love the book of Acts. I feel like in the last 5 years, maybe 7 years now, I've been through a part of three different churches. My home church that I grew up in, the last church I served in, now this one, that have gone through a different look at the book of Acts.
Never preached Acts before.
So I'm looking forward to it. I think it's a cool way to kick off the Easter season. It should be good. Changing gears in a sense of given the context of where we're heading in. Got a question and then kind of want to expound on it a bit. One of those passages that show up in Scripture that we read, we sing it a lot. In hymns and in different worship songs, this kind of language of 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 21, in talking about Jesus. And the question essentially came out of this verse, which I'll read the verse and then I'll ask the question. And I think it's got good context for us as we head into Good Friday and Easter Sunday and understanding some of these theological truths. But 2 Corinthians 5, 21, for our sake, he who he's talking about is Jesus, he made him to be no... Oh, sorry, I'm reading it out of the NIV Mind and ESV.
You want that here?
For our sake, he made him to be sin who knew no sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. I was reading ESV and speaking NIV. I'm still like, some of those, like, you know, you memorize the verses like, as a kid, mind. And it's like, you're just reading, but you're... I've done that a few times in the pulpit. I was reading like, out of Philippians 2.
Yeah.
My brain was correcting what I was reading, and then I got lost, and I lost my place. Anyway, he became sin. For our sake, he made him to be sin who knew no sin. And that's a phrase, he made him to be sin. Made Jesus to be sin. This idea of being sin. And so the question essentially that came in this week is, in what sense did Jesus become sin? Did he really actually become sin, and how does that happen? Or did he get treated like sin would?
Yeah. Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, and it's a little bit mysterious, because I would love for Paul to keep going and explain.
Yeah.
I think all theologians would be like, tell us more about how this works, because this has been something people have thought about a lot. What we're getting at here is the doctrine of imputation, is the word impute. And here's a definition of that word, which I have here. To think of as belonging to someone, and therefore to cause it to belong to that person. God thinks of Adam's sin as belonging to us, and it therefore belongs to us. And in justification, he thinks of Christ's righteousness as belonging to us, and so relates to us on this basis. So the idea is that God imputed our sin to Christ and imputed Christ's righteousness to us. Double imputation. There was a transaction, a trade, a switching. So, but in what sense did Christ become sin? So the one option is that he was treated like sin, though he always remained holy, perfect. But he was treated as if he was sin, and we are treated as if we are righteous, but we're not. I actually think there's more going on than that. I think that there's a very real sense which on the cross, Jesus actually became sin. Not that he committed sin, but that there was something happened where he was imputed. So he was thought of, God thought of him as our sin, and in such a way that it actually caused him to be sin. That in a very real sense, Jesus became sin. So that when he was on the cross, the Father looked at the Son and saw a sinner. And treated him as such. But it wasn't just that he treated him, but he actually was that. Hmm. That he was, in a sense, a murderer, a thief, a crook, a covetous, lustful, whatever. Not that Jesus did those things, but those things were imputed to him so that they were his part of him in some way. And I think that because I say that because I think that's what the verse is saying, that he became sin. He made him to be sin. Made him to be sin. And there's a mirror. So whatever happened to Jesus happened to us in the opposite. We aren't just treated like we are righteous, but we're not. We are actually made righteous.
So that we might become.
We actually have become the righteousness of God. So then God looks at us. He sees us as righteous. We are the righteousness of God. We truly have become the righteousness of Christ. Just as Christ truly became sin. See, the things, they mirror each other. So however it goes one way, it has to go the other.
And 1 Peter 2 says the same thing. Essentially, kind of does the same
thing. Same idea. Yeah.
He himself bore our sin in his body on the tree, that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. And it's funny because at first it looks almost the length, 2:24, 1 Peter 2, chapter 24. Sorry, I'm throwing you a curveball here, but it just crept into my head. But like the idea of bearing, this is what crept into my head as you were answering that. The idea of bearing sins, is that different than becoming? But
in his body.
In his body. That was the phrase that stuck with me that goes, no. Yeah. And then that we might die to our sin and live to righteousness. So not, and I think that, I'd be curious to know the Greek word for that, but as opposed to for. So one could live for righteousness with the purpose and intention toward righteousness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But to live to righteousness means like that is clearly the direction you're in.
Yeah.
And you're going to as opposed to for.
Another similar one is...
Sorry for the curveball.
No, it's good. Galatians 3:13. Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us. Right. For it is written, cursed is everyone who is hanging on a tree. So that in Christ Jesus, the blessing of Abraham might come to the Gentiles so that we might receive the promised Spirit through faith. That on the cross, Jesus became a curse. He didn't just
wear a curse.
It's not that we were cursed and he took it for us. He actually became a curse for us.
And it's separating that from the idea of becoming the curse or just being the victim of a curse.
Yeah.
As opposed to, and it's the same idea of like, we were talking about this earlier too, but the idea of becoming sin versus simply handling the discipline or the repercussions of our sin.
He didn't just take the penalty, amazing as that is.
Right.
Right. So that on its own is praiseworthy. But he actually became the essence of our sinfulness. He wore our filth.
Which would be why it talks about the Father turns his face away.
Yeah.
To not look, because it's not the clear spotless lamb as just the sacrifice for sin, but God turns his face from Jesus becoming sin.
So it's built off the, in some ways, this is all prefigured in the atonement rituals of the Old Testament. So like that priest puts his hands on the head of the spotless, perfect, blameless animal. And there's a sense in which the sin transfers from the person to the animal. And the animal then has become sin and is killed for it. And the person has become innocent as the animal was and walks away and is actually innocent. And the animal is actually guilty. So this is the idea of imputation or double imputation. It's sort of the technical theological term. And that definition I read from Wayne Grudem is also, he mentions Adam's sin. So there's actually another imputation that happens, which is Adam's sin was imputed to the whole human race. That Adam actually sinned on our behalf. When Adam and Eve in the garden, the idea is, and this is a kind of Romans 5, the idea is that Adam, when Adam sinned, we all sinned with him. That he acted on our behalf. And that his sin, his rebellion, was imputed to all of his descendants. So that Adam's sin is internalized in me. I sinned in Adam. So, and I have the effects of the fall because of that. So the theological way is saying, everyone has sinned by nature and by choice. We are sinners by nature and by choice. We all choose to sin, but we also are all sinners by nature as Adam's descendants.
Oh, yeah.
So it's both. It's not just by nature. It's not just by choice. It's both. Nature and by choice.
And I've said as a new dad.
You can affirm that. Yeah.
You can affirm that, right? Like it's like
by nature and choice.
You have, if you're not convinced of sinful nature, have a kid.
Yeah.
Or spend some time with I mean, my kid's 6 months old now, but like even at 3 months, you can just see this willful disobedience.
Yeah.
Even in the finite structure of their minds. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's all by, Adam's sin imputed to the whole human race. Christ's righteousness. So our sin imputed to Christ. Christ's righteousness imputed to us.
So it's transactional. That's the beauty of the gospel.
It's trade.
It's a trade. It's
the great exchange, Luther called. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm taking the word. Yeah.
I was about to say it.
Yeah.
But like this idea of it's not just we're not just. He's not just giving, he's just giving and we're just getting.
Yeah.
But there's a transactional, I think the imagery is great, especially heading into the weekend we're heading into.
And the resurrection then is not so much that Jesus was innocent and therefore God raised him.
Hmm.
Some people would say that. I actually don't think that's quite the right thing.
I've never heard that before when you said that.
But in fact, the resurrection shows that Jesus paid the penalty fully. He completed the punishment.
Right.
That the penalty was fully paid so that he could not be held in death any longer. So the resurrection proves the completion of the payment of sin.
And I find that there's something that's one of my least and most favorite parts of Easter weekend. It's the same thing. This idea of coming face to face with the actual reality of the death of Jesus.
Yeah.
I found myself at the channels the other night, and there's a documentary. I don't know if you've seen much of this, the Killing Jesus show. No. They're showing it around National Geographic. I didn't see much of it, but I saw the last. It was perfect. So my wife came downstairs and was like, "How much is left?" I'm like, "Well, Jesus is dead now, so there's probably like 10 minutes because he's gonna be raised, and then they're gonna end." Like that's kind of how these shows generally work. So you could timeline it. But just I thought they did a decent job. From the biblical standpoint, having just read through John and Matthew's account of that stage, it's brutal.
Yeah.
And the thought I had in my head, even when you were talking about the sheep, is like, I wonder how that would shape us in our sin if we in reality saw a lamb paying our penalty, recognizing that there is cost.
Yeah.
To sin, and that's the thing I love and hate about Good Friday, because it's a punch in the face, in a sense, because you're seeing the costs, and you don't want to skip over it, like you don't want to skip over it, and just we could just get to Sunday,
mm-hmm.
if we wanted to just talk about the resurrection, but without the cost, you don't see the full picture of the resurrection.
I think that's absolutely right. I think there's something lost in our culture that doesn't kill animals. Like, you know what I mean?
I know what you mean. What I mean?
Like, that was probably the worst way to
I'm
say
like,
it.
Yeah, I'm like, if we could just, take that clip out and like, PETA would be all over you.
Okay, I'm not advocating animal sacrifice at all, but I think there's something pretty powerful about you're there, the throat of the animal gets slit, his blood spills out, you can smell it.
Yeah.
And then they burn it. And you can smell it. You can almost taste it in your mouth. The smoke rises up to heaven, and you walk away free. I mean, it's a powerful... I've never done anything like that, obviously. But I would imagine that would be an incredibly powerful thing to experience. Actually watching an animal die in your place. Mm-hmm. And going, that should be me. That should be my blood. I mean, we celebrate communion and say, Jesus' blood was shed instead of mine. But to actually watch, say, an animal... actually have his blood shed instead of yours, and then you walk home, go home alive, you know, to actually having never seen someone be killed before, never seen a crucifixion, never seen an animal sacrificed. So I just, in our culture, we're protected from death. So yeah, I think it's something we've lost a little bit. Not that I would want to go back to that type of thing, but we have to work a little bit harder at picturing someone getting killed and someone's blood being poured out for us. That probably wouldn't have had to, they didn't have to work up their imaginations. I mean, crucifixion was a public thing.
Yeah.
People crucified all the time in the first century in Rome. It's very public along the highway, like basically equivalent of a highway. There are major roads into Jerusalem or other places. So it was a normal thing to watch someone hanging on the side of the road dying. So when you picture Jesus doing that in your place and suffering on top of that, the wrath of God, not just the wrath of the Romans, we have to work out in our imaginations to picture it. They didn't.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and some of these films where they depict these things, you know, it's always an interpretation, and there's always kind of, we call it dramatic license or theatrical license that they'll take in these recreations because they have to, right? Because there's certain things we don't know, like we talked about last week. But I found that in this Killing Jesus movie, and I'm not endorsing it by any stretch because I didn't get to see it all. I just saw the end. But like, I thought it was pretty on point in how they kind of showed his crucifixion. And it was unsettling to watch.
Huh.
Like, just, like, can't look away, but can't really look right at it. They did a good job, and it's kind of left me with this unsettled feeling, which is, I'm looking forward to celebrating a good Sunday, but not before really wrestling with Good Friday. And so, with that, we just say, if you're listening to this week, join us on Good Friday.
6:30
in the evening.
Yes.
And then, make sure you're part of Sunday morning as well, and be here, invite your friends, we'll celebrate, Jesus conquering death.
Yeah,
it's not the end, but as always, if you have questions, please do send them to the B-side. We didn't get to everything we hoped to today, but hopefully next week we will be able to get caught up with all the questions that we do have. But as always, it's better to have an abundance of questions than
we can be picky and pick the ones.
Yeah, than not enough. But appreciate you listening, and hope we'll see you this weekend.
Yeah.